Okay. The title for our talk tonight is called Symbolism and the Aquarian Age. And it's for a little while, it's going to sound something like church. We're going to talk about things from the Christian perspective. In the first chapter of Romans, that is attributed to St. Paul, but we don't know for certain, there's quite a remarkable statement that I'd like to read. It says, "We all beheld the now invisible glories of God, even unto the Godhead, but by sin and vanity we degraded ourselves to darkened ignorance and coarse deeds." We all beheld the invisible glories of God, even unto the Godhead. Now that's quite an outstanding statement, but it is a statement of fact that has been corroborated by other seers, by mystics, Max Heindel included. This is to say that at one time we all had spiritual vision of a very high order. Now, this seems almost incredible, and it seems so obvious that we wouldn't do something that would destroy our capacity to see the spiritual world. It says, "We chose darkness over light." Now, we certainly wouldn't make that choice with our present consciousness, and we certainly wouldn't make that choice if we knew what came out of it. So there must have been something subtle in the whole matter. It's always more subtle, especially when we are talking about the Lucifer spirits who helped us get into the jam that we are in now. According to clairvoyance, the Lucifer spirits, who at one time were the highest of all of the angels, when they persuaded us to take the creative energy into our own hands, they promised us immortality. Immortality through procreation. And they offered it to us as an autonomous freedom. That was their selling point. And they really did fulfill their promises. And they gave us some very good things. First of all, when our eyes were opened, which means that we develop perception of this outer material world, the whole without was available to us, which had never before been available to us throughout our entire evolution. We could see the whole external world and we could experience it directly. Now, everything that we were told was true. It was true in ways that probably even the Lucifers couldn't foresee. Now, a good deal of the fix that we are in at this time is not due to what they told us, but to what they didn't tell us. When we fell, according to the biblical story of the fall, there are others, and they all pretty much agree with each other. It is what they didn't tell us and how they told us what they did tell us. Now, the problem was not that we took the creative energy, which is also the procreative energy if it is used physically. It wasn't that we took that into our own hands. It is that we took the creative energy into our own hands at the wrong time. And we didn't know how to use it, and we didn't know why to use it or when to use it. So we are told, like, for example, in the Rosicrucian Cosmal Conception, we are told that we took control of creativity before we knew how to use it in terms of harmony with the rest of the cosmos. And what we did is we introduced ad harmony into the whole creation. This is one of the options that is available to us. We are free to go against the whole process if we want to. It's an awfully stupid thing to do, but we can do that. And part of the reason, but certainly not all of it, but part of the reason was that we took the procreative energy into our own hands for very selfish, sensual reasons. And this is what St. Paul means when he's talking about vanity. So we can see that one of the big problems was ignorance about the matter of time. Now, in the spiritual worlds, anytime you turn inward, you learn that time is a very different thing. And even at that, the understanding of time in the inner way is not really clear and easy. At the time of what is called the fall, we did not have logical capacity. We didn't understand logical sequence. And so we couldn't make connections about cause and effect or about cause and consequence of having reactions to our deeds. And this is symbolized in the biblical story, saying that we hadn't long enough eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So when we did this and we put creative actions out that we could not foresee the consequences and that we did not know how to deal with the consequences, we produced an imbalance. And that same imbalance is present with us to this day. Many people, I don't know if it's the majority of them, but many people produce more problems and more troubles for themselves than they can possibly redeem within one lifetime. And so as a consequence, all of us, over many rebirths, have what is called in Christianity a burden of sin. We have a lot of unredeemed, harmful things, selfish things that have built up, and we've never been able to liquidate it. Now, the imbalance was something different than that. It was self-perpetuating, and it continued to make things worse. When we chose to use the creative force to excess downwardly and outwardly, we directed our attention more into the material worlds and away from the spirit. And the consequence of this imbalance was that we did not have insight working harmoniously with experience. It's all right to make mistakes, but if we learn from those mistakes and we have intuitive insights into what those mistakes mean, we grow. But when we have become so preoccupied with sensation and material living, we take that experience and we neglect the insight. And as a consequence, we make the same dumb mistakes over again and again and again. I'm willing to believe that everybody in this room has had the experience of doing something stupid and doing it again and again and again because we don't have the insight to understand that that's what it is. You know, we make the mistakes and don't even know that we have made the mistakes. Now, the story of the fall, as it is told in the Bible, is we are seeing that our eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that the big sin was disobedience. against Jehovah. Now that's a little bit hard for me to swallow because I'm a child of fire and not a child of water, and I don't believe that obedience is the be-all and end-all, but it is probably one factor. Now, when Paul uses the word vanity, it helps a lot to understand this all. It intimates that selfishness, which is another name for vanity, and not merely the use of the sexual energy was the problem. It was that it was used selfishly. And when it was used selfishly, this egoism that resulted from it changed our perception or our viewpoint on the whole cosmos. Previous to this, when we were inward, our consciousness was more universal. We were part of the general unity of all humanity, and we were unconscious altruists. But when we changed the perspective from altruism to the individual, we changed the entire outlook. Our perspective became subjective, and it became, you know, it's me against the world kind of thing, and we lost that universal understanding of things that was previously ours. So this produced an inversion, that we saw things backwards. We saw things not in terms of the purpose for all of humanity, but we saw things from our own point of view only. Now, since then, over the many thousands and thousands of years since that time, the inversion has become more complete, so that now people in their vanity think that they are equal to God, and we have all of those kinds of inversions. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy, like other modern Western philosophies, claims that the fall of humanity was not a complete disaster, and that some very fine things can come out of it, things that were not planned for in our evolution. They can come out of it if we take advantage of it. Now, when we were cast out of the Garden of Eden, that's another way of saying that we lost our inner vision. We used to be able to see, as the statement from St. Paul says, right to the very Godhead. And we closed that off, and now we see only from our own selfish point of view, and we see only outwardly into the material world. And some philosophers have called that an isolation or quarantine or an exile from heaven into a world of barren matter. But in this world, we actually do have a freedom. We have a very special freedom. We can do our creative life experiments. We can live our lives the way we want to live them without being led around willy-nilly by the divine spiritual hierarchies the way we used to be. You know, there's nobody that we can see, you know, commanding us to do things, whether we want to do them or not. We have that kind of a freedom. And we can even sin if we want to sin, and we can work ad harmoniously if we want to, and it seems that we are almost prone to it, almost as if we have developed the habit of working inharmoniously. So we can see that we're going to learn, because from the knowledge of good and evil, we know about cause and consequence, and we know that everything we do is going to have a retributive reaction to it, and through that we learn. We learn the nature of the law from the outside. We can look at it as objectively as we now look at law in physical law in the sciences. That's one of the benefits about all of this. There are many other benefits to our fall from grace, but it would take a whole series of lectures to talk about them, and that's not our purpose. We're only going to look at one of the consequences of our fall into materialism. And we're going to look at it as it pertains to the Aquarian Age. And that problem is a problem of illusion and of repression. And in this series of talks, this is the talk that relates Pisces to Aquarius. So we can, we're finally done with the first introduction. This whole talk is almost all introductions. And by the end of the night, we'll actually say something. Let's start by telling part of a story. A story that is not a Bible story, but it is parallel to it. And if we get into the charming world of pagan mythology, it gets me out of sounding too much like a preacher, because if I continued in the other vein, I would be pounding my fist into my hand pretty soon, and we certainly don't want that. Yeah, one amen and I'm out the door. I have nothing against that way of approaching spirituality, but it's just not me. In the Greek mythology, there was a place called the Garden of the Hesperides. And some mythologists or mythographers claim it was very far to the west, and some claim it was very far to the north. So we'll say it was somewhere in the northwest. And in that garden, there was a tree. And it was a tree, I forget who gave it, but when Zeus and Hera got married, they were given this tree. And the Hesperides, whose garden it was that the tree was planted in, were very unique beings. They were called the Touch Sisters because all they had to do was touch you, and they knew all about you. And if they didn't touch you, they didn't know you at all. Now, the tree was guarded not only by the Hesperides, but there were other guards. First of all, there was the thousand-eyed Argos, who kept one of the eyes was open at least all of the time. And the other guard of the tree was called Kluber, who was a dragon who wrapped himself around the base of the tree and never let anyone approach, even though he slept under the tree. And in the tree, there were other creatures that slept. Most notably, there were bears that slept in the tree. And in this tree, there were Aphrodite's apples of life, which were an invaluable prize, that if you ate them, you had eternal life as long as you were eating the apples of Aphrodite, which is a different story from the Adam and Eve story, but it's parallel. Now, obviously, it is the same story, because when we are in the external world, all of our senses are called, or used to be called, the five senses of touch. And we're talking here about an externalization of consciousness, and the Hesperides represent an innocent sense of touch to know everything in the external world. The tree was probably the electromagnetic field of the earth, because if you have etheric vision and you're standing near the North Pole, you can see that the pole of the earth, the energy of the pole of the earth, comes out like a big trunk, immense trunk, and then it spreads out like a tree. You've all seen magnetic fields. You've probably had them in your high school or maybe even your grade school class. In one point of view, It is the Bodhi tree that Buddha put his back to when he had his enlightenment. And from another point of view, it is probably the world tree that Christ Jesus was crucified on. The dragon is the constellation of Draco, which used to wind around the North Pole. And the bears that sleep in the tree, if you would look through the light energy of the North Pole, if you look through, you would see the constellations of Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, which are the great and small bears. And the eyes of Argos are the stars themselves, which are at the same time the apples of Aphrodite, that the life comes not only from our sun, but from every other star. It's as if the stars are pinholes into the spiritual worlds that are worlds of light and of creative love. Now, Richard Wagner, in his Ring Cycle, had a similar story, only they were called the apples of Freya, as they are in Norse mythology. And he has it happen right in the first of the Ring Cycle, that after the gods have built a new kingdom for Wotan, he wants to welch on the bet. And the bet is on the deal. And the deal is that, you know what I just did? I used a racial epithet. I called welching. So if there's anybody Welsh in the group, I apologize. It's in the language, and it's so much that you don't realize it sometimes. But the deal was that they would get Freya and her golden apples for building the new palace for Wotan, and he did not want to pay up. And so they said they would settle for the gold of the Nibelungens instead, and he didn't want to give up the gold of the Nibelungens either. So he had to give them Freya because of the contract that he had, unlike the contracts with AIG. he had to give them Freya, and when they took her away, the gods were no longer eating the apples of life. And they all start to wither away right on an opera stage. And to see a huge, big opera star wither away is quite something. They have to do with light effects. If you've ever seen the opera, they all turn gray, is the way it is. So you can see that this tree, which is a tree of life, fits in North mythology, it fits in Greek mythology, and it fits in Hebrew mythology from the Old Testament. If we go back to Genesis, we see that in the middle of the Garden of Eden was also the tree of life. So there were two trees, or one tree by two different names. There was the tree of knowledge, and there was the tree of life. And in the same way that the tree of life was guarded by the Hesperides and the dragon and everything else, the tree of life in the Garden of Eden was guarded by various spiritual beings who kept us from eating of its fruit. Because if that were the case, we could perpetuate bodies, even very imperfect bodies like we have now, and we could be immortally ill or something like that. So what we're talking about here, we're talking about how these stories relate to our life in this world. Because we don't have much light in this world. And our life here is rather dead. You know, this world is moribund compared to the inner spiritual worlds. Even the sun, which is the really big apple, which is our primary source of life, light and life, is only available on a part-time basis. And the life that comes from the sun has to be translated to us by the plant kingdom, or we don't get the life. So the way it is, the images don't match perfectly, but in this world we're something like desert plants. We have brought ourselves to a state of evolution where there is little of the water of life. And we spend so much time holding on to that little bit that we do have that there is little left for any growth. It's kind of ironic because we took the power of creation into our own hands so that we would have immortality and immortal life. And the consequence of it was, because of the way we did it, we end up with very little life and too much matter. Our lives are repressed. We finally got to one of the words that the talk is about. Our lives are repressed by the weight of materialism. The spirit is encased in material repression. And we have made our solitary confinement in this world, we have turned it into something like cruel and inhuman treatment. The life that we need is more than just sunshine. It is a vital life so that we can really live. It's like a water of life. We also need feelings, emotions that motivate us, especially to higher kinds of feelings. So we need a water of feeling. We also need truth in the form of thoughts, because that's the way we generally perceive truth. So we need a water of truth. So when we're talking about this water that has been specialized in such a way that we can use it, we're talking about the apple. And so the apples of life are of vitality and of emotion and of truth and of intuition all at the same time. They are vehicles or vessels of those things for our development. So they are something like libido. So that the stories of eating the apple being associated with sexuality and with libido, which carries emotions and thoughts and everything else as part of its being, as it's concentrated in the spinal fire, which is what we're talking about, which is our personal private tree of life and our personal private tree of knowledge, we're talking about libido. Now, probably the most important vehicle for bringing this life in light and wisdom to us has been symbolism. And so we finally got to the topic of the night, symbolism. And symbolism is well suited to bringing inner spiritual world life in light to us. Myths and stories, are alive. So they carry life. We just saw that all of these stories spring to life quite easily. Symbols have morals built right into them. All of the stories have them. And they satisfy our psychological needs. So the symbols are very important in that way. And they have that special way of conveying the spiritual worlds into this material world in a way that we long for. And, you know, almost any child, in fact, almost any adult longs for those stories because there is something of that other world that leads us to where we want to be spiritually. And where we are lost from because of our preoccupation with matter. Symbols are flexible, and they're ambiguous enough so that they have many different sides of interpretation. And so all of the different nuances of truth from the spiritual worlds can, or not all of them, but quite a few of them, can be carried through symbols. Symbols are capable of variation. They can be woven into a fabric so that you have an entire mythos. And they can be adapted to different people at different times. They point to moral growth, and they point to evolutionary objectives, which is why the stories were given to us in the first place, so that we would have the moral guidance until we could see it for ourselves through experience. Myths change as the times change. People change, and their myths change with them. So we're talking about symbols and how flexible they are. Now, there are many different kinds of symbols. Some things are made into symbols that are not symbols in their basic being. Trees. We can look at a tree, if we carve our initials in it, you know, John loves Mary, that tree then becomes a symbol of something more than just a tree for what it is in itself. Even nature forces like fire and water have a symbolic character that goes beyond just their physical nature. And we can even take some things and we can superimpose symbolism on them, whether it is good for them or not. We do this a lot with our pets. We say, here's a good doggy, as if the dog knows what a good dog is compared to any other. And when we project all kinds of things on our dogs, we neurotify them. This is why I like cats. They aren't so easily neurotified. I might as well start a struggle here between the cat people and the dog people. Sometimes symbols are very abstract and very artificial. We have geometric figures and numbers that stand for relationships that can only be seen with the invisible eye, with the inner eye. They can't really be seen physically. Sometimes we need to be disrupted from our materialistic phlegmatism. We take things for granted here, and we are presented with symbols that are incongruous. For example, in mythology, we have gryphons and sphinxes and all kinds of animals that are incongruous. They don't fit together right. And if you're interpreting your dream and you're trying to get at the most meaningful part of the dream, you look at the part that's the oddest. You know, all those impossible things happen. So symbols can bring us right to the point where we are to direct our consciousness by being incongruous. Again, sometimes symbolic elements are woven together and we have a whole grand mythical world around us. We just saw a piece of that grand mythical world when we talked about the Garden of the Hesperides. Then there are also symbols that are compounded of other symbols. And the most complex of all of these symbols are called mandalas. And mandalas arise in cultures from all over the world. We are treated in this city, every now and then the Buddhist monks make sand mandalas, which are beautiful. They're brilliant in color and they have all of these details to them. If you get to sit next to Ila in the class, you get treated to a partial mandala every time there's a lecture because she makes drawings in classes according to what's going through her psyche. The word mandala comes from primitive people. Primitive people who, when they needed to dance, without the use of any instruments, would form themselves into a perfect circle, and they would dance in that perfect circle round and round until they had worn away all the vegetation, until there was just earth there. It's really interesting because one of the most advanced forms of dance is modern eurythmy, as developed by Rudolf Steiner. And all of my friends that have gone through eurythmy school find that the first thing that the class does together as a class is finds the ability to make a circle. It's as if that the circle being the spirit of being the symbol of spiritual perfection is universal to any kind of expression. One of the most grand mandalas of all is the astrological mandala. In the astrological mandala, all of the constellations are lined up with all of the signs, and all of the signs are lined up with all of the houses, and all of the planets are in their sign and house of rulership, and the aspects are implicit within it. It is the ideal universe. And just about everything that is in the external universe is in the symbolic universe of the mandala, which means a lot of different thinking. For example, the battle of the sexes is built right into the mandala. If you look at the toilet doors, in a lot of establishment, men have the Mars symbol and Venus is the symbol for the women. And the martial signs are always opposite the Venusian signs. And so you have built right into the mandala, you have that kind of sexual differentiation. And you have the relationship, like for example, of immediate experience in a triangular relationship leading to education. And education, on the other hand, leading to higher purpose, the philosophy or understanding of things. And from higher purpose, you're brought to new, fresh experience. So all of these things are really built into it. The ninth house, for example, is the house of theory. It's at a 90-degree angle from the sixth house, which is the house of praxis. So theory and praxis is a constant struggle in humanity, and it's symbolized right within the astrological mandala. Now, in these talks, in this whole series of talks, which is going to be about 25 talks, we are looking at each of the signs of the zodiac relative to Aquarius. And through that, we are trying to look at problems that relate to the Aquarian age. And we're using the mandala for that purpose. Now, in the second talk, which was the flagship talk, it was called The Holy Grail and the Aquarian Age in Heaven and Earth. We noted that when you go around the astrological mandala, there are two directions that you can go. When you go forward, as the planets seem to go forward, what you're looking at is a symbolic direction of time. That things go forward. We could look at hero myths, for example, and follow them through the forward projection on the zodiac. The other way that we can look at them is by when things go backwards, like the precession of the equinoxes. And that is what we have been doing. The equinoctial is now about here in the constellation of Pisces, and it's working its way toward Aquarius, which is the Aquarian age. And so we see on the mandala, when we look at precession, we are looking at the consciousness of humanity historically. In the background of the cosmos is being directed toward Aquarius. Now, this could be looked at on a lot of different levels, but I don't want to get too far into that because we would get a field and the talk would go to pot anyway very quickly. Now, what we're doing when we're looking at the mandala is a very difficult thing. it's difficult enough to look at reality and see how everything is connected to everything else. It's difficult to look at the mandala and to see how everything is connected together in the mandala, and then to try to pass from one to the other with an intellectual understanding is an exceedingly difficult thing to do, and it's not something that everyone wants to do. I don't think that even theoretical astrology, as we're looking at it now, is for everyone. Some people are suited for it, and some people are not. Now, when we look at the mandala, it's basically a circle, which brings us to that perfect circle of very primitive people dancing in that circle. The one reality about the mandala is unity. What we live in is a universe. It's all one. It's all within that one circle, whose circumference is, whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. Now, there is a maxim that talks about spiritual unity. And the more that we can rivet it in our consciousness, the better it is, because it removes a lot of superstitions and misunderstandings of things, and it causes us to be open so that we can see how all things relate to other things. And that maxim is, everything is in everything. Very simple. Everything is in everything. So, in the same way, tonight, just go to work or something like that. In the same way that the spiritual worlds interpenetrate this gross material world, everything is interpenetrated by the one. And anything that happens on one plane is within the one. And so it affects every other plane, because everything is in everything. That's another way of looking at the use of the words. Everything, the all, is in everything. And so everything is then connected in that way. So, if the astrological mandala is to be a symbol or representation of that entire universe, it has to be like that. And even in its most simple astrological makeup, it is. We can't know something about the signs without at the same time knowing something about the planets. And we can't know something about the planets without knowing something about the constellations or the houses or the aspects, because everything is tied together. Now, when we met 2 weeks ago, we talked about the 180-degree relationship. We talked about the opposition. We talked about the fulfillment of altruism through individual love with Leo, and a few other things at the same time. Before that, we talked about the 150-degree relationship, which is sometimes called the quincunx. And we showed how the esotericism of our Pisces Virgo age becomes the exotericism of Aquarius. And how the exotericism of the Pisces age becomes esoteric in the age of Aquarius and Leo. That aspect showed how things pass from the within to the without, and from the without back into the within. It's a very abstract kind of thing. In this talk, we are going to talk about the complement to the 150-degree aspect, which is the 30-degree relationship. It's called the semi-sextile. In this talk and in the next talk, we're going to talk about the semi-sextile. Now, in Rosicrucian philosophy, we talk about the life cycle from rebirth until we are reborn again. And we know at the height of that life cycle, when we are most ourselves with a capital S, when we are divine beings, and all of our experience and all of the seeds of all of our vehicles of experience are one, and we are one with the universe, we get the big picture. We see for ourselves the divine plan, the purpose of it all. And we are filled with inspiration. And when we are filled with inspiration, we become divine beings. And divine beings give. And so we want to give. And because we want to give, we come back to rebirth. And that giving out attracts to us the matter of the various different planes until we come back to this world and are born in this physical plane. When we're inspired to come back, our whole life is set spinning, and everything spins forward. And as we spin forward, we go deeper and deeper into matter. As long as we are looking forward in life, we become more material. In fact, we continue that throughout life. We become more stony the older that we become, until we cannot sustain the will to live, the creative inspiration that set us going on this whole cycle, and we let go. And when we let go, and all of the matter is taken back into the spirit. So we're talking here about the whole life cycle. If we say birth is at the ascendant, when we get to the cusp of Cancer, where Cancer rules the womb, and that's where we come to the materialized manifestation of the physical world. And we continue forward. And we continue forward until we meet the limit of our capacity to move forward. And then we let go. And then things unwind. And we reflect, and we look back, and we assimilate. This is the cycle that we do again and again and again. The same cycle, if we put the sun and the moon on the ascendant, we can follow the lunation cycle that we see every month in the heavens, and we can understand the cycle of cycles relative to seeing what happens or what unfolds month by month in our lives. Now, in this cycle, as it is on the mandala, the cusps represent significant points. The ascendant is the cusp's cusp. It is the beginning of things. It is the now. It is the birth. When you come to the first house, first cusp forward, that represents a change of state. When it's all at the moment of birth, it's all very exciting, it's all very projective, you're all going forward until you meet the second house cusp and there is a basic change of state. And that basic change of state is called consolidation. Taurus represents consolidation. It means making things dense. It means bringing things to a state of property. At the end of the cycle, when we have basically given up everything and we have dissolved everything, there is a change of state at the last cusp, and that is called collapse. So the two